Thank you for listening to the Endocrine Feedback Loop. We love making every episode, and the only thing we think is missing is you. So we're taking the show on the road, and we'll be recording a live episode at Endo 2023 in Chicago. If you're going to Endo, be sure to stop by the Professional Resources Center in the Expo Hall on Thursday, June 15th at 10:30 a.m. to watch a live recording. We'd love to meet you.
This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 37th episode and the start of our fourth season. Today, we review an article recently published in the JES in which perioperative cortisol and ACTH levels are examined to determine if we can predict in the postoperative period which Cushing's disease patients have been cured and which non-Cushing's patients have adrenal insufficiency following pituitary surgery. For those of us who take care of patients in the hospital, we frequently find ourselves asking these questions, so this paper might guide the care that we provide. As is usual for us on this podcast, this is an observational study, so we will go through the methodology carefully to try to understand exactly how the authors came to their conclusions. As a brief reminder, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop with my day job being a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University, where I direct our outpatient endocrinology clinics and serve as an associate director for our fellowship program. Joining me for another stint as a regular contributor is Katie Gutenberg. She hails from the University of Texas at Houston, where she is the director for their endocrinology fellowship. Her clinical expertise is in pituitary disease, and she is a master educator at McGovern Medical School, where she teaches extensively. Coming today from the Indiana University School of Medicine to be our guest expert for this episode is Diane Donegan. She too focuses her practice on pituitary disease and is known to you all from her research in many publications throughout the field of neuroendocrinology. As you can easily tell, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joined me to dissect a pituitary paper. As is always the case, everything we say is our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this episode, we look at cortisol and ACTH measurements at extubation from pituitary surgery predict hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis function. The Journal of the Endocrine Society published this paper in April 2023. It comes to us from the National Institutes of Health with David Isuzu as the first author. At this point, I will hand the discussion off to Katie. She will overview the key points made by the authors in their introduction. Additionally, both she and Diane will review important aspects of Cushing's disease, pituitary surgery, and the biochemical assessment of the HPA axis. Katie?
Thanks, Chase. So just to kind of get started, the requirement for glucocorticoid replacement therapy after transplanted surgery, as we know, depends on a variety of factors. So that might include the preoperative diagnosis. Does the patient have Cushing's disease? Are they presenting with a different type of cell or mass? What is the likelihood that the patient may have intraoperative pituitary gland damage? And did the patient receive perioperative steroids or not? I'll let Diane comment a little broadly in terms of the management of postoperative pituitary patients, looking at both patients with Cushing's disease, patients without Cushing's disease, and there's a variety of different approaches that can be used in terms of giving patients perioperative glucocorticoids or not, and then how and when to assess the HPA axis postoperatively.
Thank you, Katie. So I'd just like to say that the perioperative management of patients with pituitary tumors, in a way, can sometimes be a little center-specific, and in part depends on local resources, expertise, and to a certain extent, center preference. Furthermore, postoperative management of patients can differ according to the functionality of the tumor, as you had mentioned. From an endocrine perspective, however, patients are typically assessed preoperatively to determine if there's hormonal excess or to determine if there is hypopituitarism. If a deficiency is identified preoperatively, it is replaced and optimized prior to surgery. So, for example, in the setting of adrenal insufficiency, stress-dose glucocorticoids are administered intraoperatively, typically then tapered postoperatively to physiologic doses. In the absence, though, of preoperative adrenal insufficiency, two sort of postoperative protocols can be utilized. You can have, for example, expectant management, where postoperatively the patient is assessed clinically for signs and symptoms suggestive of adrenal insufficiency, and serum cortisol concentrations are assessed to determine if adrenal insufficiency has developed after surgery. The challenge has been that various cutoffs have typically been proposed to determine if somebody has adrenal insufficiency or not, with levels varying somewhere between 10 to 15 micrograms per deciliter of serum cortisol. Alternatively, patients can be placed on stress dose glucocorticoids in an expectant manner that somebody may have adrenal insufficiency to be tapered to a physiologic dose and then subsequently assessed postoperatively, for want of a better way of saying that waiting till the dust has settled and then assessing if they have adrenal insufficiency at that point. So those are the typical ways of assessing preoperatively and management postoperatively.
Thank you. That's a great summary, and I think it sets us up nicely for this study. So the authors of this study previously described what they're calling normalized early postoperative values for ACTH and cortisol, and found that it was a technique to predict postoperative remission for patients with Cushing's disease. So what does that mean? So they take advantage of the observation that the stress of surgery is similar to preoperative CRH and DDAVP stimulation testing results, and then calculated what they call the normalized early postoperative values, which is the post-extubation value minus the peak preoperative stimulation value. Again, we're talking about looking at the postoperative ACTH, postoperative cortisol, compared to the preoperative stimulated ACTH and preoperative stimulated cortisol. And then again, I'll kind of ask Diane for you to comment in terms of an overview of this measure, the normalized early postoperative value, and what the clinical utility of that might be.
One of the other things that I was going to mention about postoperative assessment of patients really is that how it differs from those that have non-functioning pituitary adenomas or other pathologies versus Cushing's. So for Cushing's, postoperative management is very different because you're really trying to assess whether somebody has remission. So in other words, you're really trying to identify, does somebody have adrenal insufficiency, which could identify that these individuals therefore have entered remission following their surgery. And you're really relying on the fact that endogenous hypercortisolism leads to suppression of normal corticotrophs, and that that postoperatively then will lead to adrenal insufficiency until they wake up. Now, many of the determinants of remission rely, as I mentioned, on the fact that these corticotrophs are suppressed postoperatively. And again, the cutoffs have typically varied postoperatively to determine what indicates remission, with some centers using 5 micrograms per deciliter as a cutoff, others using 2 micrograms per deciliter as a cutoff, or here in the authors, they had looked to see that they really didn't see a difference between 2 or 5, so they used 5 micrograms as a cutoff. But really, there's a lot of things that can play a part in determining what the postoperative cortisol is going to be. Part of that may be the timing of the sample. So when you take it, what's your cortisol level going to be at that time? Do people take samples at the same time? What assay is being used? So perhaps your cortisol values may vary according to the assay that's used at that center. And the other thing that also can play a part in your cortisol assessment would be, were perioperative glucocorticoids administered as well? So all of those things can really vary your postoperative assessment. So if you're trying to get an even playing field, sometimes using stimulated values may adjust for intra-individual variability that you might notice in a person. So I think that's what the authors have really been shooting for. They do a preoperative stimulated level and compare that to an equally stimulated level so that you're on an even playing field.
Looking specifically at the goals of this study, they don't explicitly state their hypothesis or aim, but they do state that they were seeking to map the post-surgical stress hormone dynamic starting at the time of extubation, and then also to predict postoperative HPA axis function, including one, the presence of remission in patients with Cushing's disease, and then two, the need for postoperative steroid replacement in patients without Cushing's disease. And so with that, I'll pass it over to Chase, and he can walk us through the methods.
Adi, thanks, and Diane as well. So I think it's really helpful to cover some of those important topics and ideas around Cushing disease, around surgery. And so now we're going to dive into the methods and think about that a little bit more and what the authors do here. So first of all, and this is what we typically do, we're going to think about study design in general. And I found it a little challenging to describe this based on a single study design. The authors don't. And I think they use a couple of different approaches here that we should keep in mind. One of them, I think for some of the results that Katie's eventually going to walk us through, it has a cross-sectional approach. And as a reminder of that, a cross-sectional study is one where all the data is collected at a single point in time, or at least it's processed that way. One of the reasons that I say that is part of what we're going to look at, that Katie's going to review for us, is the diagnostic performance. So anytime you're looking at that, and these are the type of results that generate sensitivity and specificity, those are typically cross-sectional studies. So I think there's a component of that here. Another one, and this is much more unusual, though it's a good observational design, is a case control study. And I think some of what the authors do here are similar to that approach. So a case control study is very different. Typically with observational studies, you start by splitting your subjects into groups based on exposures. And in its simplest form, you have a group that's exposed and a group that is unexposed. It is different in case control studies. You split your individuals, your subjects, into groups based on the outcome. So you have those who have an outcome and those who do not have an outcome. And then you go back to try to find what exposures might have predicted that outcome. And the result of that, it generates an odds ratio, which is also something that the authors use here. So a couple different approaches here. I don't think it makes a big deal, but we'll keep them in mind as we go along, and we'll circle back to that shortly. For this study, first of all, to touch on the patient data, this is a, as the authors describe it, a retrospective review of prospectively collected data on consecutive patients who underwent TSS by the same surgeon at the NIH from 2016 to 2022. And I'll mention here, the authors point this out in their discussion, that there is likely a referral bias here. The NIH, most of us are familiar with them, and they see a lot of unusual, particularly challenging conditions and cases. So a lot of the patients that end up at the NIH would not be particularly reflective of most of the patients that are seen at centers throughout the U.S. Some of them may be, but there are many, many challenging cases that they get there. So we have to keep in mind that this population may not well reflect the populations that either we see or that may be at other centers. So we have to be careful when we generalize that. And Diane's mentioned there's a lot of center-specific approaches. So we'll be thinking about this in several different ways, but definitely the patient population we need to keep in mind may not be reflective of other patient populations. Okay, so going back to this study, the diagnosis of Cushing's disease, nothing particularly unusual here, and that could be done with elevated late night salivary cortisols, elevated 24-hour urine-free cortisols, or the low-dose dexamethasone suppression test. One thing I think that would be helpful to hear Diane's comments on is the ACTH measurement. She's already pointed out that there are differences from center to center in assays that are used. But here in particular, the authors point out that at the NIH, they use a few different assays. So I thought it would be helpful for Diane to just give an overview, particularly with ACTH, because that is, it can be a very tricky lab to measure accurately. How do we need to be thinking about assay differences here, either when a center maybe uses multiple ones over time or comparing it to another center that uses a totally different one? Help us understand that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And as you mentioned, in particular for the ACTH assay, which sometimes can be very challenging to measure. But even independent of ACTH itself, when we're thinking about any assay, we always have to think about the sort of pre-analytical as well as analytical issues that can occur with any assay. But as we mentioned, in particular with ACTH, which can be unstable, and usually in the pre-analytical phase, does require it to be taken, put on ice, then rapidly addressed so that you don't have any instability associated with ACTH. But that in of itself, when we're looking at the assays, there have been several studies that have been out there comparing one form of assay to another, and we see that there's significant variation within those assays. Of course, there are other less common issues that can occur that are particular to ACTH, whether there is any immune-related adverse findings that can lead to inaccurate readings. And sometimes we've seen that with the Siemens immunoassay, but that's usually going to be identified when the individual is being diagnosed at the time. But as I mentioned, that there really is assay variability. And so if a study is using three different assays or more within the one study, that can be a real challenge to apply to your own patient or to even be applied to other assays. Be nice if they had run a study to see how they have varied between them, what were the coefficient of variations or those sort of numbers so that you'd be able to compare assay to assay. But I think that when we're looking at the results, we need to bear that in mind when we're interpreting the study.
One other comment that the authors point out, particularly about the Cushing's patients, is that these patients underwent confirmatory inferior petrosal sinus sampling, IPSS. All the patients underwent that with Cushing's disease, except for those that had a dexamethasone suppression test and a CRH or DDAVP testing that was concordant, and the MRI showed an unequivocal adenoma. So most people got the IPSS with that one exception there. And then for individuals who had pituitary lesions that were not Cushing's disease, and that could be either pituitary adenomas or non-adenomatous lesions, so they were evaluated with a dedicated pituitary MRI, and they also had complete pituitary hormone panels as well. As we think about the post-surgical outcomes, a few things that the authors mention. So they state that all patients had morning ACTH and cortisol measurements preoperatively and at extubation after the surgery. And I thought that was a helpful inclusion for the authors to state. I think it alleviates some degree of concern here about an ascertainment bias. But what an ascertainment bias is if you are looking for something different in one patient versus another based on some information that you have about the patient. Now, this often happens in clinical care, and it's completely appropriate. But as you're looking at a study and trying to understand, did we find something unusual in this group because there is really more or less of it, or is it just because we knew something unique about them and we went looking for it more often? And so it's really helpful in these studies when the authors are able to say, no, it didn't matter. We always did this. We always checked it the same way. It really alleviates a lot of concern. So I think that was a strength, particular with these measurements. And moving on here with what the author said in particular about Cushing's disease. So they state a few different things about measurements. So they say, first of all, the preoperative ACTH and cortisol levels were measured prior to CRH or DDAVP stimulation testing. And then postoperatively, they measured it at several time points. So plasma ACTH and cortisol levels were obtained at 6-hour intervals, starting at day 0 and going all the way through postoperative day 3. And they define, as Diane mentioned already, early remission from Cushing's disease as a plasma cortisol less than 5 within 10 days of surgery. And that value that Katie's already introduced us to, that NEPV, that normalized early postoperative values, they did it for both ACTH and cortisol. And that was calculated as the postoperative value for each of those, subtracting the average post-CRH or post-DDAVP stimulated value. Okay, so we're going to come back to that and think about that some more. Final, a few other comments here. So in both patients with Cushing's and those undergoing pituitary surgery for non-Cushing's disease, corticosteroid replacement could be started for a couple of different reasons. So one, if the cortisol was less than 1, that was a reason why. But then also a second reason, if there was concern by the clinicians that the patient had symptoms of hypocortisolism. So this is where I would give an example. This is maybe a little bit different than what was done with the testing, is this did allow for some variability here. So you do have to worry about ascertainment bias. And potentially it could be if you were particularly worried about a patient having adrenal insufficiency because you knew some of these lab results, then maybe you were asking questions different. Maybe you're doing something different. Again, in patient care, this is exactly what you were supposed to do. So there's nothing wrong or bad here. It's just when this gets translated into an observational study, sometimes you do have to wonder, how did that information get obtained? Were there different thresholds to do things in one patient versus another patient? You don't worry about that very much when it's something objective, like your cortisol level was less than X. But then when you get symptoms thrown into that, it can be a little bit challenging. So we'll have to think about that as we interpret these results. For the individuals, the patients without Cushing's disease who are undergoing pituitary surgery, a cosentropin stimulation test was used to confirm the need for corticosteroid replacement on postoperative day 8. And that could be based on either a baseline cortisol of 7, or the other cutoff that was used, an increase, a post-stimulated value up to 18, 60 minutes after that cosentropin administration. And Diane, Katie, and I thought this would be another place that would be helpful to get your input, in particular, helping us think about the utility of using cosentropin stimulation tests just about a week or so after a surgery. And then also that cutoff of 18. There's been a lot written about whether that cutoff should still be used, particularly with newer, again, assays that are out there. So help us understand those two questions about cortisol testing.
Well, I have to say, you know, when I was reading this paper, I was a little bit surprised that they were using an ACTH stimulation test so soon after surgery. That would not be the typical practice that I would employ in my own institution, primarily because when we're thinking about the cosyntropin test, stimulation test, we're thinking that usually ACTH is a trophic factor. And so absence of ACTH will lead to atrophy of your adrenal gland. And that typically is estimated to be around that sort of 6 weeks or a later timeframe. And we're often sort of concerned that when we're looking at an individual that we have a high suspicion of having adrenal insufficiency, but an event occurred quite acutely, that would be one time where we may not be able to interpret our ACTH stimulation test as accurately, because that is often normal in the setting of your adrenal cortex having sufficient function and hasn't had enough time to atrophy. So I was kind of surprised about it. I did look that there was a reference that was provided, I think on the paper, it looked at 19, but that really didn't provide any information regarding the ACTH stimulation test being used within that time period postoperatively. So I would not be very familiar about the evidence or sensitivity and specificity of an ACTH stimulation test in this time frame postoperatively. Okay, so with regards to the cutoffs, yes, this is a very sort of hot topic at the moment of trying to decipher what is going to be the most appropriate cutoffs based on our assays becoming a lot more sensitive. Previously, with polyclonal antibodies that were used for the assessment of serum cortisol, as we're moving more towards monoclonal assays now, the cutoffs have decreased as they're not picking up a lot of other sources that might cross-react with the assay. So the cutoffs for these seem a little bit lower, but that really depends on the assay that you're using. And so it really, you have to know the assay in your own institution before you can apply this sort of newer cutoffs as opposed to using 18 micrograms per deciliter, which had been with the older assays. Also, with the newer assays, there isn't necessarily agreement as of yet what cutoff to use, because this has also varied with the newer ones, with it seems like the mean coming out at around somewhere around 15 micrograms per deciliter. But again, that really depends on the assay that you're using. With the newer assays, when we're talking about the ACTH stimulation test as well, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on sometimes, whether you use a 30-minute versus a 60-minute can also be another area of controversy. But just to be aware, in essence, that there are these considerations that you should know your assay if you're going to use a different cutoff from the standard.
Good, as if Cushing's disease was already not challenging enough, we can make it a little bit more challenging. Good, that was a very helpful overview, Diane. So just a couple comments on statistical analysis. So first of all, the author stated that the predictors of early non-remission were identified by univariable and multivariable logistic regression, with early non-remission being the dependent variable. And second, the predictive ability was assessed using areas under the receiver operating characteristic curve. So with that, I'm going to turn things back over to Katie. She's going to walk us through these results and continue to have Diane chime in to help us think about these things as we go along. So Katie, why don't you take over the results here?
Starting with the patient demographics, the vast majority of patients, almost 80% of the patients in the study, did have Cushing's disease. And then among the patients with Cushing's disease, early remission was confirmed in about 89% of patients. I'll just ask Diane to comment briefly in terms of how this patient population might compare to other centers.
I think when you look at the other centers, and the way that I'm going to compare it is really when you look at the literature and those that have published their information, really the estimated remission rate is somewhere around 80%. So I think that this is in that region that has been reported out there in the literature. Obviously, there's going to be a reporting bias in the literature, right? Those that have a lower remission rate may be not as likely to report their findings. So, you know, at least it's in line with those that are willing to report those. Now, that's usually it for kind of all comers, if we take individuals as all comers for Cushing's. If we really then look at repeat surgery, it is well known that repeat surgery is going to have a lower remission rate. That's estimated to be around 60%. And of course, even within these cohorts, we have to take the individual as well. So success rate of surgery is going to be more likely in an individual that has a microadenoma, whereas success rate is going to be lower in an individual that has a macroadenoma, in particular, an individual that has cavernous sinus invasion. That makes remission rate to be less likely. And the other caveat that's probably a little bit more unique to Cushing's disease as opposed to other functional tumors would be if you don't see a lesion preoperatively. Success rate in that is also going to be affected, lower than the kind of all comers 80%.
So I'll walk through some of the specific findings that were reported in the results section. So first, we'll talk about evaluation of the HPA axis in patients with Cushing's disease compared to patients without Cushing's disease. So ACTH levels at extubation were lower in patients with Cushing's disease compared to patients without Cushing's disease. And I think this is an expected finding because we know that patients with Cushing's disease have a suppression of the corticotrophs due to the hypercortisolism. There was no difference between the cortisol values at extubation in between the two patient populations. So moving on to look a little bit more broadly at the post-surgical stress hormone dynamics, so specifically looking at the timing for both ACTH and cortisol, there was a significant increase in plasma ACTH levels at extubation that was followed by a rapid fall over the next 12 hours. Similarly, plasma cortisol peaked at extubation, but showed a broader peak levels with levels remaining elevated at 12 hours. And cortisol levels then fell slowly and stabilized over 40 hours. So a little bit in terms of a longer duration, took a little bit longer for those cortisol levels to come down after surgery. Plasma ACTH was highest at extubation for all the patients with Cushing's disease, but did not differ between patients that were in remission versus patients that were not in remission until 6 hours after extubation. So this is just highlighting that among patients with Cushing's disease, it takes a little bit of time, maybe a few hours, for those ACTH levels to decrease after surgery. So we'll move on and we'll talk a little bit about the normalized early postoperative values. In multivariate logistic regression, so here they adjusted for age, gender, and race, the normalized early postoperative value for ACTH and for cortisol at extubation appeared to be a reliable predictor for non-remission. Now, if we look at the actual numbers, so the odds ratio for ACTH was 1, and the odds ratio for cortisol was 1.1 with a confidence interval of 1 to 1.2. So I'll just stop there for a second and Chase can comment in terms of interpretation of the odds ratios and the confidence intervals in this study.
Yeah, and this is something I had to wrestle with a little bit. So I think I've come up with what the authors were doing here, and maybe why it's a little challenging to think about. This is what I was referring to before, and I said it's set up like a case control study. So in this situation, what the way the authors did their analysis is they started with the outcome. So they put people into two groups based on, did you have this early remission or did you not? The non-remission. And that, so those were your outcomes. And then they looked back at predictors and then that generates an odds ratio. There's a few different ways of doing that, but I found that a helpful way to think about. I think the challenge here is that what they were looking at, these predictors were continuous variables. So in particular, the ACTH and the cortisol. And there's a few different ways that you can do that analysis, but often if you're keeping it as a continuous one there, then that odds ratio is per unit. So when we think about that odds ratio for cortisol, it's then per microgram per deciliter. And then when it's ACTH, it's the picogram per ml. And I think that's then a challenge because that's not a big change. So because initially you can look at an odds ratio, we'll take cortisol, it's 1.1. And that is almost always a very underwhelming odds ratio that suggests that it's not doing very much. But I think that's because it's per unit here. And so I think that maybe causes some challenge and really had to think about this clinically, statistically, it's a completely fine thing to do. It's statistically significant. The p-values are less than 0.05 for both of those. It's just really hard to translate that into something clinically. Sometimes what will happen, you maybe lose a little bit of information here, but often what people do is that this is where you'll group people into, say, quartiles. And then you can say, well, if you're in the fourth quartile versus the first, then your odds ratio is this. And typically that's a much, that in this situation, that would be a much larger number and maybe a little bit easier to think about. Or you could say if you had some sort of a threshold that you identified, you could say, well, if you were above versus if you were below, then the odds ratio is this. So I think what they did here, it was appropriate. I think it's just in the way that it was, it's really hard to translate that into clinical meaning. I think, Katie, the other information that you're getting ready to go through is going to be a lot easier to think about when we start trying to potentially translate this into clinical practice.
So the next part that I want to talk about is the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve analysis, which I think is a little bit kind of easier to think about in terms of the outcomes that they were looking at. So that indicated that patients with a postoperative serum cortisol level near or above the preoperative CRH or DDAVP stimulation levels are likely in non-remission, right? So that makes sense. So if a patient has an elevated cortisol level similar to their preoperative stimulation cortisol value, that's unlikely that patient is in remission. The next part that is important to think about is the specific secretagogue that was used and how that impacted the results. So CRH led to a more robust ACTH stimulation compared to DDAVP. And I think that's partially why there was a diminished predictive ability for the normalized early postoperative value for ACTH. In contrast, there was no difference in the percent increase in cortisol or in NEPV cortisol calculated using CRH versus DDAVP. But there is some impact in terms of which secretagogue is being used in terms of interpreting these data. And then the last thing that I'll talk about is the plasma ACTH at extubation in terms of using that number to predict the need for steroid replacement in patients without Cushing's disease. So first, in patients without Cushing's disease, about 50% of the patients ultimately did require steroid replacement. Cortisol at extubation was not significantly different in patients without Cushing's disease requiring steroids versus patients that did not, but ACTH did seem to be a predictor. And they used an ACTH cutoff of 117, below which steroid replacement was needed and predicted with a sensitivity of 92% and a specificity of 78%. All right. And then with that, I'll hand it back over to Chi so he can walk us through the discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, Katie. So, well, I will start with where the authors start in their discussion, and that's a couple of key findings that they want us to take away. So first of all, their first key finding is that the NEPV, if it is greater than -2.1 in patients with Cushing's disease, it predicts non-remission with a sensitivity of 71% and a specificity of 69%. And then the second key finding is that an ACTH of less than 117 in patients without Cushing's disease predicted the need for glucocorticoid replacement with a sensitivity of 92% and a specificity of 78%. So a couple of cutoffs that they have suggested for us here. And the authors then state something that was interesting. Another place I want Diane to give us some information on is the authors state that this data may help guide early reoperation in Cushing disease. So the idea being is that if with that cutoff, that first key finding there is that if it suggests that these patients were not cured, that they are not going to have remission, and that then maybe we need to be thinking about a surgery sooner than is typically done. So Diane, tell us more about that. I don't know how many centers are doing this early reoperation in Cushing disease, but update us on what's going on with that.
Good question. I even spoke to one of my surgical colleagues to say, hey, you know, how real is this? Doing it early, is this really such a benefit? I mean, some of the ideas that have been touted about early reoperation being of benefit, some of the things that they've mentioned is that healing hasn't occurred, so there isn't scarring, reossification hasn't happened yet. And when we look at papers, when we see where residual tumor is or where recurrence occurs, it's usually at the site of where the previous tumor was. So being able to find the surgical bed may help you identify the area that needs to be targeted if you're going to do early reoperation. The one thing that I would say, though, is what has been defined as early reoperation has really varied in the literature, with some being within 24 hours, others being within 7 days, some of them up to 28 days. And I don't know if there really has been much comparison to determine, well, which is the best time. Some of the other reasons that people have mentioned early operation or reoperation is beneficial is that it avoids excess hypercortisol exposure for the patient if they haven't been in remission initially. It might be able to avoid a second admission for that individual. Then when you're thinking about if that's within 28 days, does that still really apply those other benefits that people are discussing? But from a surgical perspective, I think if it's done really early, maybe being able to identify the surgical bed and using that as a target for you to be able to operate in that area may be of benefit.
Good. That's helpful. So more that needs to be understood there. But I think the authors are right that if that is something that is proven to be beneficial, that this data may help us figure that out as to who should be operated on sooner rather than later. Okay. So another comment that the authors make, so they point out previous work, these authors have been working in this space for quite some time, and they point out that they've previously demonstrated that recovery room cortisol also predicts remission in Cushing's disease. And at this point, the authors state that they say, we hypothesize that NEPV for cortisol would result in earlier prediction. A couple comments that I would make here. So I was a little surprised to see that there. Katie mentioned that at least in the introduction, there wasn't a hypothesis there. So I found it a little bit odd that a hypothesis showed up in the discussion. It was a little bit hard for me to think about this if they're comparing that NEPV. So with the extubation versus a little bit later in the recovery room, if that's going to make a big difference clinically, since those two events are relatively close to each other in time, but something that we can continue to think about here. A few other comments that the authors make. So they point out that in non-Cushing's disease patients undergoing a TSS, that the plasma ACTH, but not the cortisol level at extubation, predicted the need for postoperative hormone replacement. And they point out that the half-life of ACTH is very short, just 22 minutes. And so that it is possible that the acute anterior pituitary gland injury may not yet result in plasma cortisol changes, but the ACTH is actually different. And so they then reiterate that those ACTH values above 117 at extubation did predict patients who would not require steroid hormone replacement postoperatively. A few limitations that the authors point out. So they show that their sample size is relatively limited here. And they also point out they don't have long-term remission data. So the data that they looked at is relatively short-term. And as we've talked about already, they say, hey, this is all, these are all patients from a specialized clinical center. And so we have some limitations on generalizability there. The authors also point out some strengths, and they point out that they had uniform procedures here. We mentioned that already, is that is really helps with eliminating ascertainment bias. They point out that all these surgeries were done with a single surgeon at a single center, and that there was extensive endocrine assessment, really allowing for a thorough understanding of what's going on there. Finally, the author's conclusions, and we're going to wrestle with these, but a couple of key points that the authors make as they wrap up here. So they say, first of all, the NEPV cortisol predicted remission in Cushing disease at extubation, improving at 6 and 12 hours, and that plasma ACTH and non-Cushing disease predicted the need for steroid replacement. And then they comment additionally that larger studies may help further refine that NEPV cutoff and improve its clinical utility. So we're going to think about whether this should change our practice here in just a second, but I wanted just to wrestle a little bit more with just the quality of this report overall. Katie, maybe I'll get your input on this. You and I spent a long time thinking about this and walking through this paper. So what are your thoughts just on the quality of this report overall?
Yeah, so I mean, I think sort of, and we'll talk about the utility or how realistic actually, you know, using some of this is, but I think sort of the idea from a pathophysiology perspective of using the NEPV, I think is sort of an interesting idea that they're proposing, you know, whether or not it actually would work in your practice. For the patients that don't have Cushing's disease, I would have liked to have seen maybe some longer term data. You know, we talked about how they reassessed the HPA axis on post-op day 8. I think it would have been helpful to see what maybe the cortisol was 6 weeks after surgery or a year after surgery so that we have a little bit more of a better sense in terms of how these predictors are in terms of predicting long-term intact HPA axis function after surgery. Those are some of the things that I was thinking about. I don't know, Diane, if you want to comment as well, too, in terms of your thoughts about the study.
Well, I suppose about the methodology and the conduct of the study, I think it was, you know, they outlined their comprehensive protocol. So I think, you know, it wasn't that we were sort of left in the dark guessing how things were done. So I think they were pretty explicit in that. So that was good. Yes, there are some limitations in terms of the assays, but they highlighted that there was changes in the assays. So it was good to point that out. You know, they did mention things like putting it on ice. What would have been nice as well is they mentioned 6 hours or Q6 hours that they're doing labs. I want to know what the sort of the standard deviation would have been around there, because is it close to 11 hours is counted in the 6 hours, maybe that might have an implication in terms of your timing when you're measuring the samples. I'm just thinking when we're trying to translate it practically into the clinical scenario, you know, how strict do you have to be with certain timings of samples as well. But overall, I think, yeah, it was performed well, written well, but then we'll come into how it translates clinically.
Yeah, let's stay right there. And Dan, let's stay with you, because I think you really helped us think about this. So as we think about it, and the question is, so this NEPV cortisol, particularly for our Cushing's patients, and then the plasma ACTH for the non-Cushing's patients, should we be using that? So I think in particular, as we think about that NEPV, you pointed out that you have to use this stimulated value, and that's maybe not routinely obtained at a lot of centers. And in particular, now with CRH not being available and DDAVP being a less potent stimulator, given those two big caveats, so this isn't information that we maybe routinely have. We would have to add this to a protocol to get it. Is it helpful enough? So is this something that we should start adding to what we're doing right now? Or do we really need to do what the authors are saying? Do we need to totally put this on pause and we really need to wait for more data to try to understand this? So help us decide on that. Are we ready to do this? Should we start putting this into practice or no? Do we need to hold off and wait till we have more data?
Well, I think the challenge here is how many people are doing the stimulation tests preoperatively. Typically, these stimulation tests are something that you would entertain when you're thinking about there being an out-of-topic source or sometimes something like that when you're doing further investigations. At the end of the day, if you have IPSS, really doing some of these testing does really not make it all that helpful. If you have CRH available, great, but we don't. And as we can see from the vast majority of these patients that were assessed, CRH was the main agent that was used within the last year, likely reflecting the fact that ovine CRH was not available is when they transitioned to DDAVP in this study. So that was only sort of a smaller fraction of the patients that were tested. They did say, though, that this did not have any impact on the cortisol, that really no differences were able to be seen on ACTH. So really, with the one that counted at the end of the day, the cortisol, there was a difference that was able to be seen despite the agent that was used. But if you're thinking practically, this would add further time for the patient and would add further cost as well, when really is it having a great discriminating factor postoperatively? How does it truly differ in terms of using the cortisol to indicate remission versus these stimulated results? And really having such a fine difference of minus 2.1 and how that really translates into other assays as well, I think requires further study, but also perhaps a cost-effective analysis, right, might also play a part.
So Diane wants to wait a little bit, think about this a little bit more, maybe understand some cost factors as well, which I think is always important. Katie, why don't you give us your thoughts? So UT Houston, are you ready to start advocating that you folks implement this as a protocol, or if you want to hold off, what sort of information would you want to see before you were ready to move forward with something like that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agreed with everything that Diane is saying. I mean, I think sort of conceptually, it's sort of an interesting idea. I just think in practice, I think it's going to be challenging to implement, and I'm not sure how much it actually adds in terms of assessing your postoperative cortisol value. I would say the same thing for what the authors are saying about checking the ACTH level at extubation for patients without Cushing's disease in terms of an early predictor for whether or not the patient needs postoperative steroids. You know, getting at some of the logistical things that we spoke about in terms of one, needing an accurate ACTH assay, and then also just the timing in terms of how fast it takes for an ACTH assay or how fast it takes for those results to come back. I don't know how much extra information it provides compared to, say, checking a serum cortisol value on post-op day one or post-op day two.
And with that, I would like to thank Katie Gutenberg and Diane Donegan for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.
Thank you for listening to the Endocrine Feedback Loop. We love making every episode, and the only thing we think is missing is you. So we're taking the show on the road, and we'll be recording a live episode at Endo 2023 in Chicago. If you're going to Endo, be sure to stop by the Professional Resources Center in the Expo Hall on Thursday, June 15th at 10:30 a.m. to watch a live recording. We'd love to meet you.